This week's episode of Buffy Virgin is brought to you by DennisComics.com. Dennis is a cartoonist who appears on almost every episode of Buffy Virgin. He raves about monsters and recommends great horror movies that no one else has ever heard of. He has two short comics in the Halloween issue Devil Think that came out last year. Dennis's original graphic novel, Amelia, which is really the thing I should mention first. It's very Lovecraft meets David Cronenberg, and I know other people have said that, but it's a wonderful, dark, and interesting read. Pinup art by Dennis St. John is also featured in issue 5 of Rich Tomasso's She-Wolf, a super interesting read. She-Wolf is beautiful, artsy, and strange. If, when you're listening to Buffy Virgin, if any of Dennis's recommendations for other films and stuff resonate with you at all, then you would absolutely love his comics. Dennis has a really well-developed horror sensibility that comes across in his comics. If you like horror stuff at all, you'd really enjoy his stuff. So get your horror comics fixed at DennisComics.com. That's Dennis with one N, D-E-N-I-S, and comics with an X because it's cool, C-O-M-I-X. In every generation, there is a virgin. He alone will watch the vampires, the demons, and the forces of darkness for the first time at least once a week. I am a Buffy virgin. Well, welcome to another episode of Buffy Virgin. In this episode, we watched a two-parter, season 2, episode 9 and 10, What's My Line? And we watched the whole thing, and we're going to talk about the episode, both parts, in one episode of Buffy as opposed to breaking it over two. So, as we normally do, let's introduce everybody here who's on the podcast. It looks like there's Dennis, a horror comics cartoonist.
Hey, everybody. Good to see you. Dennis St. John.
But just Dennis to me. And then there's Travis.
Hey, everybody.
And John.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
All right. So those are the voices you'll be hearing. Everybody's here this week, which is awesome. So let's start with a plot summary of both parts of this episode of What's My Line? We open on a sunny Monday morning in the cafeteria. The gang is jumping through Principal Snyder's Hoop of the Week and trying to find out how they feel about shrubs. Buffy is glum and gloomy. Her fate is sealed, she thinks. As the smart one, Willow's the only one really interested in her future. We cut to Spike and Drusilla and the smart vampire Dalton. Despite the big vampire brain, all that Dalton translates is base, beef, and canoe. Drusilla, playing a very bespoke tarot deck, figures out the key to reviving her. It's hidden in a crypt. Buffy surprises the vampire vandals, but only one fights. Smart Dalton makes a break because, well, he isn't the kind of vampire that should be fighting traffic, let alone the Slayer. Buffy comes home to find Angel lurking. She says he's the one freaky thing in her freaky life that makes sense. But how will she feel on Freaky Friday? We don't know. We do discover that she could be a veritable Slayer on ice, so to speak. We find the Fates have decided that Xander shall be a prison guard, and Buffy was selected as a potential policewoman. Poor Willow wasn't given a career based on her test, and she goes to investigate why. Meanwhile, Giles is much more hysterical than usual regarding the theft in the crypt. Buffy and Giles figure out the vampires robbed the reliquary, that's a collection of bones and other artifacts, of an excommunicated priest, Duloc. We find out that he made a special cross-o-matic invention to help translate his evil writings. Buffy can't stick around to help with research because she has to go skating, ice skating, and all is well and good until she's attacked by the Order of Taraka. This is a two-part episode, so it's stuffed with different plot points. We see another new figure, a girl, who is voyeuristically watching Angel, in vamp makeup, necking, but not biting Buffy. Buffy goes to Giles with the ring she took off the baddie, and he freaks out, and freaks her out, and she splits for Angel's apartment. Angel unfortunately is surprise attacked by Kendra, a woman who claims to be a vampire slayer. He's imprisoned in an impenetrable cage of chicken wire and left to rot in the sun like a garbage can. Buffy, who is actually at Angel's, is surprised by this perky Jamaican-sounding tough gal. Eventually, they figure out they're on the same side and call a truce. It turns out that when Buffy was dead, she was, like, really dead. Xander wastes no time hitting on the new slayer, despite the earthworm-related smoochies with Cordelia. Looking quite sorry and nearly dead, undead vampire Angel is unceremoniously dumped in the sewer for Spike to pick up, and torture. By now, all has been revealed, and it's Drusilla's sire, Angel, who holds the key to her restoration and revitalization. But the only way for that to happen is an extremely violent and sexual act, and of course, it's also sacrilegious. The gang rallies at the church, and with Kendra as the surprise that Spike never saw coming, near disaster is averted. Also, things look pretty ominous as Drusilla is super powerful at the end of the ritual. Buffy and Kendra part ways as she keeps trying to teach her to learn to slay and have a life. Awesome summary. Really love that. Really concise. Really hit tight. All the highs and lows. Super
dynamic.
Tight.
Just one word.
I felt like I just watched it again.
So funny. All right. So let's get started with weird noticings here. So I'm going to kind of run through these. People wrote their noticings in a shared document. So there's a lot of them in this episode.
So to start off here, John, you said What's My Line was a 1950s and 60s game show about guessing someone's job.
Yeah, did you guys know this? I didn't get the reference and had to look it up. Did you guys get the reference?
Yeah, it was a Groucho Marx show, right?
I didn't see that in the, like, 30 seconds of reading the Wikipedia page that I did, but maybe isn't if you say like so.
Isn't that like This Is Your Life or something?
It's something like that. It's you have somebody up there and they are a mystery person and you ask them sort of like, I guess, like yes or no questions or something like that, and you try to guess what their job is. That's it.
That's fun
the
game.
Reference.
So what kind of questions do you ask about someone to learn what their job is?
I don't know, because like I said, I spent about 5 seconds reading the Wikipedia page. Sorry, everybody. Poor research.
It sounds like you could be like, what kind of building do you go to in the morning?
Structured, like you can't ask them what their job is, but you can ask them, you know, what tools do you use? Or
Right. So that's different because, yeah, so Dennis would say like a pen. John would say...
deadening young minds. I don't know.
That's the tool he uses.
I was wrong. The Groucho Marx show is You Bet Your Life. So
I knew you were talking about your life.
But my whole noticing was that it was a weird reference for Buffy to be aware of because she's our age and it's too old for us. So,
well, I'm sure that speaks to the age of the writers involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's as culturally aware of as a 30-year-old TV writer. So
30 to 40-year-old. Yeah.
Dennis, you have an observation here. There's a Latin word for canuo.
Canoe? Did I misspell canoe? I couldn't figure out how to spell canoe. just because at the beginning when they're reading the Latin book and they're like, they're speaking nonsense. And then Spike's like, canoe. I don't think that's right. It's like, what is the Latin word for canoe? Like, did they have...
I don't want to make fun of you, Dennis, but your spelling of canoe is bananas.
I'm going to look up how to spell canoe right now.
This reminds me, I saw at a bar was advertising a you know, get drunk spelling bee thing where it was like a competition for adults. Man, Dennis, this actually, I thought that was a silly idea. Sounds like it's an amazing.
Well, listen, because I was trying to spell it the way I thought it would spell and it kept coming up red line. So I kept typing different things in and that wasn't a red line. So I was like, all right, that's... Look, I typed my weird spelling into Google, and a picture of a canoe came up, so...
Okay.
It's there. See, look at that.
So Dennis thinks...
That's a canoe. Like,
previous to this noticing, Dennis spelled canoe C-A-N-U-O, which is a good alt spelling if you're a robot. It works fine.
Oh, you can see all the edits.
Damn it. So, Travis, your observation here, slowest paced opening of the show up until now.
Yeah. Also, and to piggyback off what Dennis was saying, was my observation that Dalton, the smart vampire, the nerd vampire, is always in vamp makeup, and his vamp makeup's it's not too subtle, so but just funny. He's one of the very few vampires that's always in vamp makeup, and I wonder if that has to do with he has to be like in vamp mode to read or use any of his. You know, to be as smart as he is, I think it's just really strange. Like, you know,
It's just so we would read him as a vampire because we don't know him,
as opposed to some human that Spike had kidnapped. Yeah,
yeah.
It's funny. It's as opposed like the only other character who's always in vamp mode, vamp makeup is was the Master. So it's just kind of a funny thing to see that with Dalton, who's like the nerdiest, just like the Jonathan of the vampires. And we get Jonathan in this episode, which is amazing. And then it's a super...
Yeah, good Jonathan episode.
Great Jonathan episode. I have more about that later. But it's a super slow opening for a Buffy episode. There's no slang. They're just in the cafeteria bantering. You know, Buffy's kind of negative, you know, negative Nelly or whatever. But no one dies in this opening.
So where's the expression negative Nelly from? Just curious. Is that another old-timey one that we...
I don't know.
Because I bet if we did a TV show... I mean, if this was a TV show, and it's not, but if it was, I'm sure people would be like, Meg Nelly, huh? Wonder how old the writers were.
Well, the best part is, you could tell how the whole nine yards would bother someone back in 1997 when they couldn't Google Wikipedia.
Yeah. They're just defeated. They're just like, I'm upset.
So I want to jump ahead to that because I have a note about that. The whole nine yards is actually there's a New York Times piece.
It's a huge thing.
Yeah, there's nobody knows the origin of the whole nine yards. I found this whole New York Times article, And there's different theories and different like sort of apocryphal origins about how it was like the length of a bullet belt that you would feed into a machine gun in World War II, or it was the length of a cement truck, then you would fill it all the way up and it'd be the whole nine yards. But both of those have been disproven, but no one knows what the real origin is.
Well, like the one that was first recorded was like 1865, and it was so-and-so put enough cotton in that, put the whole nine yards of cotton into that shirt, you know? And so it was just an expression. I think that was the first time anyone found it, but I think it's just, yeah. So I think that expression just took off from there, the whole nine yards, just to mean the whole. I mean, the best part is I don't think there's like a metric equivalent. I mean, you can ask your girlfriend, John, but I'd love for there to be a metric equivalent to this bad boy, you know, a whole 3.3 meters, you know, or something like that, a whole 3 meters of, you know.
So did anybody read the article, or are we just guessing?
I did. This one I actually read. Yeah. So the thing is, yeah, there's what's really cool about it is that it digs into these like weird internet cultures of people who try to find the origins of expressions like this. And they're called antedaters. This is really weird subculture of antedaters. And antedaters are people who, you know, they try to find an earlier date of publication of a certain phrase. And the article I read was that the earliest one that they could find was, yeah, from like the late 19th century, but it was like the whole 6 yards originally.
Yeah, there was.
They don't know what it was 6 yards of or why it was 6 yards, and they're still working on it. So this is like a mystery for the ages. The guy described it as the most prominent etymological riddle of our time in the article.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just like a movie title that was even remade, right? So it's like, as far as people know, it's like Adam Sandler invented it.
But like as early as like the 60s, people didn't know what it was.
Yep.
Like, so like, it's not like, or like as recently as the 60s, like it's not like a super ancient, it's not a super old fashioned phrase. Like it's actually a fairly recent thing that people say.
You know, not enough gets written down as humans. You know, we don't cover all this stuff. It's funny, like reading into stuff while I get ready to go to Rome and Italy in a month or so, and like just how little information we have to prove anything. Like the number of primary sources are so limited. So it's like, yeah, we got the Pantheon, but like, why was it built? Who actually built it? Like, guesses. And that's crazy. That's for a building. Yeah, but anyway, whole nine yards, who knows? That's really funny, John. So, John, your next observation here, you had a publishing aptitude test publicly. Really?
I don't know if we need to spend too much time on this, but the whole career day at Sunnydale High is pretty stupid and obviously cruel. I mean, that's the point, so... I think it's exaggerated for effect. The feeling is real, right?
I feel like we had like an ASFAB and we had an aptitude test like this at school where they did say recommend, you know, what kind of careers you could do. I actually took a sub career test, which I guess we'll get to in a questions here. But yeah, publishing publicly is a huge mistake.
It's crazy.
Hey. So next one here. I asked, what's wrong with Drusilla? And this thing about her weakness kind of gets resolved in part one, part two of this. Like she's weak and she'll become strong and there's a ritual, but like I didn't have a sense that she was, I mean, she acts funny, but I didn't have a sense of her being messed up or like she could be more powerful. So I don't know, the whole what's wrong thing and like Spike treating her funny is weird to me, but I guess it gets resolved within this. So yeah, she's sick. I guess
I had the same question. I was also confused for whatever it's worth.
If you remember, earlier this season, you know, like Spike's always alluding, Pet, we have to get you well again, or this place will, you know, you'll act your old self. She's like a lot more functional being sort of sick and down, but you saw that's why she was always in those bedroom scenes, like resting and sleeping. And, you know, he brought her that girl in school hard for her to eat. Mm-hmm. Right?
And
that's where it comes from.
Yeah. And in the episode where she tries to eat the kid, like Spike's like, you shouldn't go out, Pet. And the fact that she was trying to eat a kid instead of a full grown human. So it has been set up.
It's really
and
subtle.
In School Hard, they refer to like in a couple weeks when the stars align, like this town will burn. So I think that's what they were referring to is the events.
So it's just a non-specific weakness, though. They don't say like, oh, she has vampire anemia. You know, it's just like, yeah, she's...
She was tortured in Prague, and there's actually a comic that reveals that she was tortured by a wizard or a spell dude or whatever who made all of her injuries, like, physically feel permanent. So that's why she was weak and didn't heal like a vampire would.
Yeah, I like that you called a wizard a spell dude. Like,
whatever. I don't know what his class. I don't want to speak for a guy's classification. I'm not sure.
Right. No, wizard's a whole book in Dungeons and Dragons. There's so many subtypes of wizards you can be. It's not fair.
Yeah, and he could have just been a mage or something. I don't really know.
There's like a lot of inconsistent stuff about the Watchers Council that we'll get into. But I was watching some. I was pretty melancholic, and so I was watching Angel season 1 and 2. And they actually give some great background to the Watchers Council and like other stuff. Like I wish I could bring up.
It seems like the Watchers Council maybe just doesn't communicate with Giles at all. Like, yeah, there seems to be a lot of disorganization in the Watchers Council this episode.
There's a lot of disorganization around Giles just period this episode. Like Giles is carrying a ton of books and nobody wants to help him. And then he's talking about reading other Watcher diaries, like he's trying to catch up for unknowledge. And then later, when the other Slayer shows up, she's ready to talk, or Kendra, whatever, she's talking about like Watcher stuff. And Giles is super interested. And it sounds like he didn't read the book she's talking about, which is why he wants to know more. So like, yeah, Giles is way behind on his Watcher duties and as it shows up in this episode. And that it's like a silly meta game going on in this episode, is that Giles should know more about what's up. And that, anyway, we can get to that later, I guess.
And then I just want to go on a quick early rant. For those of you who have the DVDs, it's actually, there's a commentary for What's My Line Part 1, but I listened to the commentary for What's My Line Part 2 by Marty Noxon, who co-wrote the episode and was a co-producer. And she explains like a couple things about the episode and a couple like backstories. But it's kind of filled with spoilers because she was working on Buffy season 5 when she recorded her commentary. So there are a couple spoilers for later in the season. So I think I would recommend listening to it because Marty Noxon is really great to listen to. But like she will drop some spoilers about the plot points with that. But definitely recommend everyone get the DVDs because early on in the series, they did do fun stuff with commentary. And in this, one of these episodes highlight that. So definitely check out the commentary if you can on the DVDs.
And the DVD, have we talked about the season 2 DVD menu and its amazing visual effects?
That can be its own podcast. It's so amazing. Yeah. It takes 30 seconds to watch an episode of the
film. I know. You can't just click it. You have to watch a whole CG walkthrough of the cemetery. It's something.
So we have some more stuff here. Travis, you said Dalton is the first vampire to use running away as his primary attack. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty great. I mean, he's the first, you know, cowardly lion vampire. Usually we see all these dumb vampires, and even if they're old or if they're young, they just kind of just attack the Slayer. And this guy's like, yeah, all my friends have been killed by this Slayer. I'm out of here. And so it's kind of like fun. His character's a lot more fun thinking about now than I...
when Buffy recounts that story to Giles, she's like, they were using tools and everything. That's where the whole nine yards thing comes in. But that proves my point that it's unusual for vampires to use tools. That they like are weirdly like animal. Except for Dalton, who's like, maybe I should use a chisel.
Travis, you got another one here. Buffy calls out Angel as a cradle-ropping boyfriend.
Yeah, this always comes up, this age gap. You know, John did the calculations. It's what, 2150 or 2200 before they can date? I can't remember the exact date, but you can listen to one of the other episodes.
2220.
There you go.
2525.
So it's like it's like crazy. I totally forgot she calls him a cradle-robbing boyfriend. In like a cute, funny way. And this is the whole romance that I know and no one else buys into. And this the whole romance between these two episodes is kind of strange. But, you know, I think it's one of those times where Buffy says something kind of funny but kind of true. And the writers are just trying to tread lightly on some subjects but still bring them up. That's my hunch where this comes in from.
I actually defended this relationship in this episode. I said that later on in the notes, things like this is the first time they feel like a good couple to me. Like just they seem comfortable with each other and stuff. So this is like the first time where it's like clear what their relationship is, you know.
I agree with that. There was another moment, though, of Buffy's self-awareness earlier where she says that this is Snyder's hoop of the week, referring to the career day. And I think it's great that she's noticed that Snyder has a new hoop for the kids to jump through every week that's totally crazy and arbitrary. I appreciated that bit of awareness from Buffy.
So there was also a Tuesday line in, like, around that, right? Where he's tomorrow's Tuesday.
Yeah, it's like the skating rink is not used every Tuesday. And I think Buffy jumped time slots a couple times, but I think this was probably being broadcast Monday at 8 o'clock or Tuesday at 8 o'clock. I can't remember when it was broadcast in the early days, but
It was always Tuesday.
Angel was on Monday, so I remember that a lot. But then I think that jumped time slot by the end of the season series for Angel. But I've got to go back and look at that. But Armin Shimmerham is the last credited actor on the opening sequence. So,
all right, John, you call out how great the maggot guy is here.
I don't know if I have anything to say. Yeah, Dennis,
his name is Norman Pfister.
Oh yeah, I wrote that name down too.
It's that's a weird ass name. I like the bug guy. I don't understand how he kills anybody.
Yeah,
but he looks cool.
Well, the show doesn't explain either, right? So just like, it's just people scream and they cut away.
Yeah, the effects
maybe
also
if he was
like
made out of like a more threatening style of bugs, like if he was made out of spiders or something. But he's made out of like mealworms. Like he's food. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the effects would have worked so much better if they had used live mealworms instead of like dead ones. Cause there's the scene towards the end of part two where they're coming under the door and it's clear that it's just a pile of dead mealworms that they're shoving through the crack in the door. And there's no crawling happening anywhere in that. I feel like they could have done better.
So Marty Noxon talks about that on her commentary, and they had to buy these Brazilian worms that they were like, these worms were specially bought. Because they were super big and fast moving, but then she says they got tired because it was so hot under the studio lights, so they had to speed up. They recorded those mealworms coming under the door, and then that sped up recording because they weren't moving fast anymore. Charisma Carpenter had her limits, and so she says the mealworms that came underneath the door were plastic. The ones that dropped from the ceiling were actually erasers. Onto Cordelia, although there were live mealworms, or there were live worms on Cordelia for the scene where she sprayed with water. So that, and Marty Noxon says Cordelia was a good trooper, but she was not happy about any of that. The water, the worms, how long it lasted. So
she's Cordelia in real life. What you're saying, the actress
Charisma, yeah,
is Cordelia in real life.
Their names are so similar.
Anyway, so the whole worm thing was like its own whole thing. But I love how they got special Brazilian like worms because they were supposed to be great, and then they just couldn't perform. So
I have a couple notes in here. So Angel gets trapped in a cage. Is it the library cage reused, or is it a brand new cage made of fences? Just a brand new cage. Okay, and then
it's certainly as weak as the library cage.
Yeah, but Angel still can't get out of it. He's still a mess. I'm disappointed in Angel's ability to get out of this cage. It feels like it couldn't hold him.
I point out in the notes that, was it two episodes ago, vampires tore through the like metal door at the Sunset Club to get out?
Mm-hmm.
And Spike can't, I mean, Angel can't tear through this fucking like weakest chain in the world. It was weak, Angel. Weak.
Yeah. And again, Marty Noxon brings this up on her commentary. And she's like, yeah, I know we did this shit. She's like, that library cage can't hold a toddler. And it's like, yeah, we had to do this sometimes. Like, it's totally self-aware. They knew it was BS. But they're like, yeah, we had to do it. We didn't have any other options.
How about the fact that, like, every building in Sunnydale seems to be constructed with a cage? Like, is that part of the building codes that, like, every single, like, this rinky-dink bar has a cage, the library has a cage, this factory they've taken over has a cage? Why does everybody have a cage?
It's very important if everything's going to become a playset that they all have, like, places for action figures to have interactions in. So it's probably some high-level studio wrangling. They're like, hey, every scene needs a little place for a guy to go or get, you know, ejected or something.
what I liked from all that is, and I still like it, and there are a couple of the TV shows where they do this, is like the cumulative exposure to the sun. If it's not direct sunlight, if it's indirect sunlight that's cumulative, you know, just causes the vampire angel to become really sick and tired and powerless. Another good vampire series where that's done really well is the series Moonlight, which is actually produced by David Greenwalt. So that's a great TV series. I guess I could do it under recommendations, but they also have a very, very consistent way that sunlight can hurt vampires.
So, Dennis, you have a thing here. Does Sunnydale have an international airport?
Yeah, because Kendra flies in, you know, at the belly of a plane. Just like, how big is Sunnydale that it has an airport at all, much less like an international one that flies like direct from Jamaica? That's my question.
No, it's a great question. How important is Sunnydale to the world?
Or does maybe it's not, it wasn't a direct flight and she was jumping from like belly of plane to belly of plane.
Yeah, that's a fun scene. I'm surprised they even went out to an airport to shoot. I mean, they bounce around a lot of locations in this episode. That's fun. This is a stupid observation, just that graveyards are full of people that didn't think about how they wanted to be buried. And I say that because like the graveyards has this amazing pyramid headstone when Giles and Buffy are walking through it, and then just regular graves. And it's like, yeah, most people just don't think about how they'll be buried. And so there's a lot of generic headstones. If you give it any thought, you can have something crazy, but you know, why bother? Money's for the living. So John, you said shout out to Angel statue.
Yeah, we get to see Angel's apartment again, and we get to see the statue again. It looks way less crazy than it did. I don't know if it's even the same set.
I think he's decorated a little more. It looks a little bit more like more stuff, not just the one light on the sweet statue.
It's totally a random Batcave moment, right? Because it's like, oh, well, I'm sure there'll be an episode soon where they explain where the statue came from. That's going to my predictions. Does everyone have a cage? We've talked about this cage. Dennis, you said it's more cage stuff. we talked about this. So, Dennis, during research mode, Giles pulls out an image of the cross-o-matic out of the pages of National Geographic.
Yeah, I just noticed that he was using a National Geographic. I was like, they'll just pull from anywhere. I don't know. It just seems like usually they're using leather-bound books, but it was like, this was actually an article in the 1963 issue of National Geographic.
Travis, you said you like how Joss treats the indirect exposure of sunlight as poisoning for vampires.
Yeah, that was exactly. I still think it's pretty cool.
And then in this confrontation with Kendra in part two, Buffy doesn't want to be the Slayer. That's kind of the theme of this episode. You know, she doesn't want that part as part of her destiny, at least the first part. That's what the career day is all about. And then, like, you know, she gets this opportunity to get out of the game, basically, and she doesn't take it. I mean, she could just totally try to coordinate it so that Kendra is the main Slayer, I assume, and get out. But anyway, I'm sure we can discuss that more later.
Can we talk about how Kendra attacks Buffy with an axe, which is like totally brutal, because it wouldn't even like, she went for her face and missed. But like, if that was a vampire, that wouldn't have even killed the vampire. That would have just like, I'm just saying Kendra's way more hardcore about the violence than Buffy. Buffy is all about like the quick stake. And she's like, I'm going to tear this thing to pieces first before like chopping its head off or whatever. Didn't even come in with a wooden weapon.
Yeah, she's pretty hardcore. I mean, she even, like, her plans are kind of stupid a lot of the time, considering that she's also a Slayer and apparently has done more research and training than Buffy, or that's just part of her ego. But yeah, there's totally a bit about how, like, we're going to run in and, you know, get Spike and kill, you know, Drusilla and all this. And everyone's like, it's so complicated. We can't just do that, Kendra. Come on. The best part
is, I assume she, even though she's been trained a lot longer than Buffy, like, she is, like, new to it, right? So she's, like, Buffy's actually been a Slayer for, like, a few years, right?
Travis, you have an interesting...
Kendra's never faced anything this big.
Yeah, so the other...
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, so I was going to say, is we talk about this a lot, like, we talk about this first season where Buffy has this sense, like, she can sense vampires. And in this episode, we have Kendra basically attacking Willie and saying... This one is dirty. I can sense it, or I can feel it. So it's kind of cool. Like Slayers have a sense for, badness or vampires. Although Kendra kind of has a lack of sense in other ways. So it's just a good moment where maybe it was consistent with the mythology.
Yeah, Travis, you're saying here Buffy gets to have a good cop, foreign cop buddy with Kendra. Is that an established style, established genre?
It's like Rush Hour style. Yeah, that's well, you know, because it's like, but Buffy's like the good cop, but then Kendra's also kind of like a good cop, but kind of like, you know, fish out of water. It's like half. So they get to get the play out. They just get to play off each other, but it's not like a true good cop, bad cop, like where the bad cop is like really bad. But you know, so it's a different dynamic. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, apparently they never intimidate their person enough for Willie to not think of like offering them nude photos or whatever, which is really creepy if you think about them being like teenagers. But
yeah, I want to call that question here. So like, how do you ask women to model nude? Clearly that's not it, but like, how do you even go about that? And anyway, having
in the middle of being interrogated, obviously.
There's never a good time, is what I mean to say. There's never a good time to model nude.
Somebody's got to do it. It has to happen.
So have we talked about this? But John, you said, do the Watchers not coordinate at all?
I mean, obviously, yeah. How like there was a Slayer died. Apparently, Giles didn't feel the need to inform anybody, and then they called a new Slayer, and they didn't feel the need to inform Giles about that. Then they're going to send the new Slayer to the place where the old Slayer maybe died or maybe is still there, depending on who knows what at what time. And nobody feels the need to inform anybody about any of that. How do they get anything done?
It seems like the fact that Giles has to read so many Watcher diaries is like maybe they're still operating based on, well, when a Slayer dies, the Watcher mails us his diaries, and that's how they become part of the public record. And then I guess Giles hasn't done that yet, because a new Slayer has been called. But I assume he's being paid by the Watchers Council still. I don't know. They should really get an email system, like giles@watchers.com.
Has anybody here seen the OA?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yeah.
Loved it. I feel like there's a great scam that they could use in order to create more Slayers here by bringing Buffy to the point of near death and doing it over and over again and seeing how many Slayers they can make. They've created this awesome loophole. They're not going to take advantage of it in this show, but clearly.
Prediction?
Oh, no way. They're not doing that. They should.
They're not going to do no way.
I had the same thought. Why don't they just, manufacture Slayers? Why have one when you can just, like, strangle them and have a million?
That's really creepy. I'd say it's because the Watchers Council wants more power than the Slayers, right? They've built themselves it's the patriarchy, man. You give too many women power, you break the chains of the patriarchy.
Travis, you say here, Kendra was sent at a young age to be her Watcher, or to her Watcher, and train with him, but how is that she only recently was called, given the power of the Slayer?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of this internal inconsistency where, it's like they know that some girls are predestined to be Slayers, but not all the girls that are predestined will become a Slayer. I guess some of the mythology they're pushing. And I haven't read all the comic books. That's a whole separate side issue. That's my problem. But I don't know in the comic books if they explain this better.
So it just sounds like that in a television show, there's a lot you can get away with as far as the mythology of a show. Like given the fact that there's so many writers, you can totally like be close to the story, like pretty close, and it's fine. Like we're upset 20 years too late about some of these like inconsistencies, but it sounds like you can be kind of in the ballpark and it's totally okay to publish.
And I saw something they just never really explained in the series at all, but like I kind of remember in the movie the idea that like a Slayer must be trained since birth, but nobody thought Buffy was like a potential or something. Like maybe there's some like,
yeah, myth Giles about throws, that. Giles throws shade at her even, you know, when Buffy's like, you know, what, there's a Slayer handbook. Why don't I have that? And Giles is like, well, you're not really the book type, so I didn't want to waste your time. Like, what
do you think that was the big vampire book from the first episode where he's like, this is the Slayer handbook? And she's like, you think that was, I don't know. Like it's called Slayer handbook.
I mean, yeah. It sounds like merch that's probably out there. I don't know.
It was a nasty insult, though. It was like, I would have given you the Slayer handbook, but you're basically functionally illiterate, so not doing it.
She flunked the written.
So next here, Travis said Spike makes an impromptu stake out of his bed. So not just Buffy is creating impromptu stakes. So maybe just a noticing.
Yeah. And I want to come back to that Giles thing, because this episode, this two-parter, I feels like the episode where Giles becomes less of a role model or adult and more of a peer for Buffy, because he throws a lot of sort of, like, I guess it kind of exposes how little he thinks about Buffy as an adult. Or this episode is really crazy because he's kind of a really bad role model and really bad adult. And, you know, he and her, he tries to boss her around when they're exploring the reliquary, and she calls him out on a bunch of crap. And he, you know, this is the episode, I think, where Buffy kind of breaks out and is a lot more independent and finally understands that Giles was holding things back from her. And I think, to me, is more Giles becomes, after this episode, Giles becomes more of a peer or advisor rather than like this true watcher controls the Slayer. I mean, there's always been those issues, but I don't know. This really rubbed me the wrong way, the way that Giles had been treating her. Treats her crappily in this episode. And so, he's nice to her in later episodes, obviously. But to me, this is more of a turning point. I don't know. I can't remember if this will really be borne out. But to me, I'm like, you know, after this episode, Buffy is much more independent.
Buffy kind of gets Darth Vader-esque when she is encouraging Kendra to harness her anger. Travis, and then Dennis, sorry.
I was kind of surprised by that. I didn't remember that at all, but she's got this really like creepy line where she and Kendra are in Giles's office and, you know, talking about emotions and anger, and it could be taken really like in a really cool, dark way. And it doesn't go dark, but it's part of her justification for why she's a good fighter, is that she is emotional and she has access to her emotions.
It's funny you thought Star Wars, because I was totally thinking Star Trek. To bring up Star Trek again, it sounded like a Spock versus Kirk argument. You know,
if you're listening to this podcast, take a drink, because Star Trek was brought up.
Take a drink when Buffy gets brought up. So the next one here, Dennis, you said Drew and Angel are hella kinky.
I mean, this whole episode is pretty kinky, I think. More so than normal. But, I mean, I think when you're a vampire, being tortured with holy water is probably the equivalent of hot wax, right? And that whole bit about, like, he makes pretty colors. It's hella kinky. I don't know what really else I have to say about it, other than I like it.
And then, Dennis, you have another good, strong one here. Is it okay for Buffy to use Kendra's accent? So she totally uses the accent to make fun of Kendra after she shoots the light out or whatever, unless there's another instance you're thinking of, right?
She says, I think it's in that scene where she's like, we're talking about torturing Willie or whatever, and she's like, you think we can make them? And then Buffy's like, I think maybe we will.
Yeah.
Like, is that okay?
I had a problem with the accent the whole time. I mean, she's doing this like comedy Jamaican accent, it seems to me. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time around Jamaican people, so maybe I don't know, but the whole was kind of off-putting the whole episode for me.
And if you listen into the commentary, Marty Noxon explains this, that they had a well-known accent coach Kendra, the character who plays, or the actress who plays Kendra, on a Jamaican accent, in that it was supposed to be really specific to this part of Jamaica, but they all felt it was a disaster and that it was horrible.
I think you got to trust your instincts on this stuff, because I heard a story, this is like for us as future creators of similar media, but like I heard a story about Star Trek Voyager, so that's another Star Trek reference, but there's a character that's supposed to be like a Native American style character on Voyager, and apparently they hired a
Chakotay.
Coach. Okay, Chakotay. Yeah, so I watched an episode of Voyager last night with my roommate, and anyway, it was terrible. It was the 39ers episode with Amelia Earhart, and anyway, the dude Chakotay apparently he was trained, they used a professional again who said he was an expert on Native Americans to like represent his culture and like to give him the training and stuff he needed. But like this character's constantly sounds like he's bringing up racist stuff related to natives and acting almost racist. And like, at least in that one episode I watched, there's a bit where a dude is like, hey, like they're climbing something and, you know, Chakotay's friend or whatever is like, hey, can't you just turn me into a raven so we can get out of here? And Chakotay's like, no, you're too big or something. You know, like who wrote this trash? And I, you know, apparently the guy that they hired to train these people was totally unqualified. And that sounds, if that's a typical story, we got two of these stories now of unqualified people doing cultural training. Like it sounds like a BS role in Los Angeles you can get.
Well, I think cultural training is probably a little different than accent training.
Accent training, okay.
But thank you for telling me that story, Mike, because you totally explained so much about Voyager just now because I'm like, oh, that's why it's like that.
Oh, really? You hadn't heard that story?
I had not heard that story, no. Oh. But I have seen every single episode of Voyager at least twice.
Which is very low for Star Trek episodes. I've only watched every episode twice.
Yeah, Voyager is fun. It has the same comfortable tone as the Next Generation, but it's different. I don't know. It's different enough. The special effects are weird. So let's move on here. Why can't Buffy's family know about the Watcher? So, you know, again, this is that Kendra, apparently her family is excited about her being a Watcher. Buffy's family doesn't even know. Why can't we reveal that? It's not that kind of show. So Dennis, you said the final fight scene, more complex than the show has done before, more characters. Vague ticking clock. I think the show is slowly getting better at staging its action. Absolutely. That was like a confusing, exciting scene, like action sequence.
Like, yeah, and they do get a little lost at times. Like Giles and Willow are fighting a vamp for a while and they stop going back to that for a bit. And then they kind of resolve it a little bit off screen. So they do get a little lost. They're not, I mean, the show is great at a lot of things, but action isn't like the thing they're best at. But I think, you know, this episode is better than it's been before. They're slowly getting better.
You also said the cross decoder has a knife, which is awesome. That is a fun, weird reveal. But that's kind of what you need to trigger the ritual of strengthening Drusilla. So,
and also Spike has to like carry a cross, you know, I don't know. It's just dope vampire stuff.
Yeah, I almost felt like it was ripped off. It was so dope. It was like that church sequence is so inspired. But yeah, Drew's really into the torture you're saying here. Seems to be getting a lot of the spell. Having a good time this week.
Yeah, I really like Drew this week. I think she's having a good time.
Can I come back to, I guess in summary for the two-part episode, for me, it was kind of a downer. I don't remember a lot of scenes that I specifically liked. I guess I'm a little bit different this week than you guys, but I mean, for me, the scenes that actually that were good that I would remember is, God, I can't remember now. Okay, so it'd be the torture scene really sticks out as like a really fun, like well-planned scene. And then I think, I thought there was one scene with Buffy that was interesting to me, I don't know. I wasn't wowed by any of the scenes. I guess the end scene with Spike and Drusilla, the climax of the two-parter, right? That one is interesting, but a lot of the other scenes like really just didn't do it for me. Weren't either dynamic enough or they're all lit well. I mean, that's great, but none that really stood out. I guess the only other scene would be the ice skating scene. And the reason that I liked that was actually furthered the relationship between Buffy and Angel. But none that really, like, I could watch the scene over and over again because it was really interesting or well-lit or well-decorated or, for me. So, I don't know. It's kind of a weird...
Do you like how in the ice arena scene, Sarah Michelle Gellar is doing her own ice skating? So she's doing her own ice stunts, but then the fighting starts and it's a different person. Like, I mean, it's always clear, but it's just interesting to see her actually doing some action scenes a little, or I mean, it's not action, but like physical scene. It made it more clear when it jumped.
I'm shocked the ice skating rink let her have the whole arena to herself, but you know, that's another story.
They're breaking in. It's closed.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Well then, shut me down. All right. So moving on to questions. John, you have the first question here. Do you like shrubs?
I like shrubs, especially as befits cocktails and stuff.
That shrubs line's really funny. It felt like a Friends joke to me when that one popped up. So I have a question. Have you ever had your tarot read? So there's some interesting tarot stuff going on because Drew uses tarot to tell Spike to figure out what to do next. I've never had my tarot read.
Yeah, and Drew's deck is like insanely specific. Like they have like a cemetery that has like the exact crypt to go into.
That's a handy deck to have.
I've had my tarot read. It was okay.
So do we all agree tarot is a kind of BS thing, but okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not asking everybody, this is not, doesn't have to get superstitious or spiritual. It's kind of a weird thing. Like there hasn't been a ton of opportunities for me to get my tarot read. No one's gone out of their way to read my tarot. My mom doesn't get her tarot read.
I had mine read once by a girlfriend. I don't really recall much about it specifically. But other than just sort of like, you know, feeling like I was indulging her. That's the whole story.
Yeah. Well, I think the way the cards work is like that they are vague enough that the statements being made, you know, apply well, you can read into stuff, right? It's that kind of thing. It's like, you know, you'd be like, oh, that kind of applies to like, you know, what I want to do in the future at work. But that kind of applies to like, you know, a future relationship idea or something. Like, I don't know. It's all open enough, which is why Drew's are awesome because they're super specific. They're like an angel because an angel's coming in.
Yeah. That's the kind of deck that a detective could really use. The one that Drusilla has.
Yeah.
All the crime. So, John, you got a question here. Did you ever take an aptitude test? And what was the outcome?
I actually didn't. I was hoping you guys had stories. I don't remember ever having done one.
I've definitely taken one. I was told to be an architect.
Hmm. I don't think I took an aptitude test. I don't remember.
I've taken those like personality, trying to figure out what type of leader you are, or how you think and how you interact with people tests. So I've done that, but I haven't taken one where it's like, you should be a blank job, because I was brainwashed from a very young age. So don't want to stir up the pot there.
Yeah, I've taken those personality tests also for work, a couple of those, both the Myers-Briggs style and the ISK style. The personality type is inspirational, influential. And so it's I-D. So it's big I, lowercase d. So these people are, anyway, they're silly people.
Usually there's four letters, and there's, I'm an ISTJ. So then there's INTJs or ESNJ. You know, there's all these different.
I bet John and I are the same. I bet John is an I-D also. And I think Dennis is probably IS or SC, but I'm not sure. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. I've taken one of maybe the one Travis was talking about. I think I was like an INFJ or an INSJ. I don't know. I don't remember. But I'm sure you're right. You can read me pretty well, Mike.
Oh, thank you. Well, no, it's just that the most creative people I know are that type, so that's why I was like, oh, Dennis is super creative, so he's one of those.
I feel like there's a lot of potential for insults here, and yep. Like what's your Myers-Briggs type? Are you a S-U-C-K? What?
Oh man,
somebody's not the main character of their own life, motherfucker.
Oh man, yeah, that's so funny, John. I want to change the delivery a little bit of that though, and go like, oh, let me just see, you're an S-U. And then, dude, I did an open mic last week where I performed, and I did a few jokes, and I have a joke that has a really punny punchline right now. And I totally did that thing where I like really overdid the punchline like you just did ish. And I felt like shit afterwards because like everybody groaned, like there was audible groans in this room of people that are complete strangers to me.
Wait, is this the Jason Bourne joke that I saw in the video?
Oh no, I've got new comedy, dudes.
Oh, okay.
No, I was doing about a joke about HBO Go, and I was joking about how there needs to be an app for people like me that want to sneak in and use the app in secret because I have somebody's credentials, you know, kind of like go to Lex Three Bears. Oh, this porridge. Oh, I want this Westworld. Oh, and then this bed. Oh, yeah, a little late night John Oliver. And I have this dirty part about, you know, the X-rated stuff or the softcore that no one views. I'm like, oh, this is right. In fact, I know exactly what they'll call this app, HBO Goldilocks. But I go, HBO Goldilocks too big. I mean, so dumb. This joke's going to come
together. You're getting pumped about your own joke.
And like, just like, I mean, there's like 50 people at this bar that don't want to hear comedy. And they're just like, ugh. It's a terrible feeling.
I know that feeling. That's I've definitely at Atomic Age Cinema back in the early 2000s made audiences groan with my carefully worked out puns. Oh,
man. They made me happy, Dennis. I'm glad you did those.
So John, thank you.
Ever been to
I had
a
popcorn reliquary? Thrown at me a lot.
Oh, sorry, John. You ask, ever been to a reliquary?
Have you? Because I have. I've been to a reliquary. Can I talk about it?
Yeah, please.
There's a really awesome reliquary. If you're when you're back in Ohio, there's a really awesome reliquary called Maria Stein, and it's like in this convent out in the countryside. And you go there, and they have this this incredible chapel altar, and it's stuffed with relics. And you know, Giles explains it pretty well. Like a first class relic is like a piece of a saint's body, like a fingernail or a piece of skin. And then a second class relic is something that has touched a first class relic. And then there's also like the pieces of the true cross, the actual cross that Jesus was crucified on, that they claim to have. Because apparently what happens is that as soon as you get a hold of a relic in Catholicism, what you must do is chop it up into a million tiny pieces, because everybody they're scattered throughout the world, and everybody's got a piece of the true cross that's like the size of like a splinter.
The true cross must have been so huge, because
the story of that is awesome.
The Warrens, the people that The Conjuring is based on, have like a giant chunk of the true cross.
Emperor Constantine's mom got the true cross by traveling to modern day Palestine in like the year like 800, and she found it, right? Which is like, I feel like there's this awesome story there where like she's like, I'm the emperor's mom, I'm looking for Jesus's cross, and some guy's is like, oh yeah, I got the cross, it's been here for 800 years. And she's like, I've got it. That must be what happened. Anyway, go to the, if you're ever back in Ohio and you have like a good day trip time, like go up to Maria Stein, and there's little pieces of saints, and they're all in this massive sort of room. It totally worth the trip. It's awesome.
No, thanks for the travel tip. I mean, I'm rarely in Ohio, but I'm as I prepare to go to Rome, I'm sure I'm going to see a lot of these reliquary places.
Oh yeah. Well, you'll see like the real thing. You'll see like pieces of hand and stuff, right?
Hand?
Yeah. Get some hand.
Right. I don't know. My dad says a story when he was traveling somewhere that there was like a saint, and like you put a quarter in the box and like it would shine a light on like a mummified hand of a saint.
Okay, cool. I'll bring my quarters.
That's awesome.
So Travis, you got one here. Why is Dalton in full vamp makeup when Spike and Drusilla are not?
I guess we covered this earlier, and okay. We don't have a good reason why. It's just a fun thing the show does.
And then you ask, who did we idolize, like how Buffy idolizes Dorothy Hamilton?
Yeah, I was trying to think who we idolize as either as kids or...
Yeah, whatever. And you have another one, which is like, who did we want each of us want to be in high school? Is that kind of the same question? Yeah.
I guess that's different, because you can idolize someone as a child and then decide to be somebody different, or decide what you want to be different. I don't know if I really remember if I idolized somebody. Who I really idolized. I don't have a good answer. Like,
I would have said George Lucas or something, Mark Hamill, one of these in high school of you, which would be
really, like, reductive. In elementary school, I met like a cartoonist, like a kid's book illustrator named Dennis Cazette, and he was like the first real artist doing like cartoony drawings I've ever met. So I think I kind of idolized him for a little as a kid. That's my answer to that.
I wanted to be Ernest Hemingway for a long time, so I was obsessed with Ernest Hemingway. F. Scott Fitzgerald. I mean, just whatever the author of the moment was, I was most obsessed with in high school.
I guess I take that back. I did meet some specific doctors who I idolized. So, yeah, I idolized real people as well.
Yeah, what's the name of that doctor on Scrubs? that Zach Braff plays, I'm sure, and then whichever
JD.
One. Yeah, and then whatever one.
Do you want to burn me?
George Clooney plays on. No. Okay.
Oh my god.
I thought we were talking more childhood idols.
No, like I said, I
your current idols.
No, no, I don't idolize either of those people. I don't know what's going on. But I did, like most children, I did have idols. And they were not false idols. They were good people.
So I think that other question of, like, who did you want to be? Or, like, that's a heavy question. I don't know. Something we could get into or not. I don't know.
Oh, is it heavy? Okay.
Well, I don't know, because isn't it a question of, like, have you grown up to be the person you wanted to be?
No, I just wanted to be normal.
Oh, well, if you put it like that,
you mean being on a Buffy Virgin podcast 20 years after high school isn't the definition of normal?
I mean, what did you grow up to be the thing that you want to be is the heavy question, not what did you want to be, right? So like Dennis framed it.
Yeah.
Do you want to answer that?
Me? No, I don't think I have quite yet. I mean, I still, like, I wanted to be a cartoonist, and I am. But, like, I'm not making a living on my own comics. So I think, like, you know, I wanted to be more of, like, a Jaime Hernandez. But, you know, I am what I am, and I'm doing okay. But, yeah, I haven't quite reached what I wanted to be. I also wanted to be a paleontologist, and I'm not that, so...
Yeah.
Where are you in life? Are you where you wanted it to be?
I mean, I'm not unhappy with where I am. I think it's really great. But like, the career stuff is really hard to predict because I feel like it's changed so much. And a lot of it's outside of my control. So it's like, I'm mostly happy with what I'm doing now. I need to work on focusing and finishing things. So I'm unhappy with the amount of stuff I've finished. I've started so many things. So, yeah, I'm not unhappy, but I would like to have more things completed. Cool. John, do you want to answer this question? Or is this a scary?
No, it's, I mean, it is, it's, I think the thing that is, yeah, there, you go through a lot of strategic retreats as you get older from your dreams. Sure. You know? I'm always in awe of Dennis for how much he's stuck to his guns in his dreams and, doing what he's wanted to do ever since, for as long as I've known him. And I know, making a living as an artist of any kind is really, really difficult. And I'm always astonished, Dennis, by the success that you've had. I mean, I know it's not, like you said, you're not, making a living doing your own comics, but still, I mean, it blows my mind whenever I think about it. And for me, there's a lot of retreats and attrition. You know, you think you want to be an astronaut when you're a kid, and then that doesn't pan out because you can't make good grades in science. And then, well, maybe you can be an academic of some kind, but you know, that turns out as a horrible idea for a lot of reasons. And then you think, oh, well, maybe I'll be I'm going to be a filmmaker and I'm going to make movies. And well, that's actually also really difficult and complicated and doesn't work out. And, you know, I mean, life is mostly, I feel like you, for me anyway, life is like telling yourself the story that you chose those things and that they weren't a measure of your inabilities. And probably both are true. You know, I'm really, really happy with what I do for a living. I really, really genuinely like it. But if I had time traveled back and told myself that that's what I'd end up doing, I think there'd be a lot of disappointment just on the face of it. But I'm okay with all of that, I think.
I think, John, like you, I think it's okay and I'm really happy with what I do as well. I guess maybe I wasn't clear about that. I guess for me, it's one thing to try things and then have it not work out. And then you realize that wasn't for me anyways. I think there's part of that. But I think for me, where I struggle is, I think I'm fighting the same demons now that I was fighting in high school. That's my problem. It's okay to try things and fail and not have things work out. And you come to how your life is. But for me, my current frustration is, even though you can accomplish stuff, that's separate from fighting your own demons or whatever, however you want to phrase it, because it's Buffy, I'll say demons. That's a totally separate issue. You can accomplish tons of different things, but if that's still the issue, that's more the issue. So that's why I'm a little bit frustrated. That's how I read it. But I'm very happy to be doing what I'm doing. I'm not disappointed in that at all.
Yeah, so, all right. That wasn't as, it was a scary question coming in, but everybody has a good answer. And nobody's...
Yeah, everybody's doing okay.
Yeah, we're all...
You guys are doing all right. All right. I agree with John that if I had done better in science class, I, like, would still be on, like, an exciting science track. I blame Mr. Guizzo for destroying my paleontology dreams.
That motherfucker. That was my first bad experience in a science class as well. It's all his fault.
Should I cut this part where you name
Robin? Well, here's the deal. I love Mr. Guizzo. So.
And you're a scientist. Look at this.
I don't know. That whole thing about all the grades and crap like that, that's a whole separate thing that we should have a total podcast on, because whole situation.
About how grading is?
Yeah, grades and how shit happens like that. And I don't know. I mean, I would love if you guys could still be scientists. Just because of this person who shall not be named, who is apparently quite controversial,
just got named.
I don't really think he was a bad teacher necessarily. It's but it was an awakening for me that sometimes things are hard, and I hit a wall in that class because, you know, it was a new school and maybe a different standard of, I was like, I'll take the advanced science class. It was a different expectation than I was used to being held to. And
so what was it, just bio? What was it that you hit the wall in?
It was, I'd never been taught science by somebody who was an expert in science before. It was part of it probably. He had, I'm sure, some kind of degree.
I couldn't tell you.
Before that, you know, in middle school, I was taught by people at the Catholic school who didn't really know anything. And I thought it was really easy. And it was also 100% qualitative, just read the book and say back what it says. And I thought I was good at science because I could do that. And in Guizzo's class, there was some fairly complicated things. And also, he was a bit mean. He was a little mean. And I didn't take it well.
I had a similar experience.
Yeah, and I want to talk about...
It was hard.
I talk about where he got his... So he actually went to UD, John. He had a master's from UD. So he knew his stuff. It was interesting. He was really demanding. So I took his class, AP Biology. That's what my class was with him. So I didn't have him for initial biology. That was somebody different. And then somebody different for all the others, the chemistry and physics. And then I had him for AP Biology. So that was my experience. So it was... one class, and we had 8 to 10 students. I couldn't remember. So it was small. So, but he was still really demanding in that class. So, yeah.
So my follow-up to this is that about safe spaces in schools and how you really need a safe space to learn and to feel safe. And that means not only safe, like I don't want the, you know, ICE to come and take me away, but also that like if you get a bad grade, you're not a bad person. And for the personal persecution that some teachers make you feel like a bad person for messing something up. And when you ruin that safe space, you ruin a child's ability to learn and like, or even care when you make them feel unsafe. And like, I know that as an adult, and that's part of what I do at my job is trying to create a safe environment for education to happen. And like, that's just true of life. Like you're not going to commit to a conversation even if you don't feel safe. Like we all feel safe here sharing, right? If anybody felt unsafe, there would be no sharing happening. And like when teachers do that, John, like you're talking about with Guizzo, like it's done. Like that's all it takes.
Yeah. I mean, seeing it from the other side, I have probably been the mean teacher as well. I probably, you know, have been the thing I'm complaining about at some point, for somebody, because the sarcasm is... a language that some of us speak culturally. And I know I certainly do. And so that comes out sometimes in ways that are inappropriate and are not okay. And it's hard to predict what's going to put somebody off. But that said, there are some teachers who are downright mean in my memory. And Guizzo was one of those.
This is a great self-help book.
Yeah, to be fair, like I've also had like, sorry, I've also had like really mean art teachers, right? I mean, it's just happened because I've had a lot of art teachers and people who like, for, you know, personal reasons, I felt didn't like my art and stuff because art's subjective. But it didn't like crush my artistic spirits because I was like tougher than that with my art, but I wasn't tougher than that with my like belief in my like ability to understand like scientific reasoning, right? But I still do know like the scientific order of animals, the kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. So I can recite that like nobody's business. Even though I think that's all, at this point probably been like edited a lot and there's a lot more subspecies and stuff. But Guizzo really got that into my head. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species.
Woo! I guess the question is maybe, I don't know. I mean, also like learning in high school is such, it feels like it's, you know, you have, it's like that scene from Indiana Jones where the giant boulder is chasing after you. Like if you screw up at one point in high school, either early on, there's no coming back. Like you're screwed up for like 4 years. Like it feels like,
yeah,
very strange. Totally. Like I wish there was like a way where like if you screw up once, if you screw up and like you can just like you need like an ejector seat to get out of that and then like reset up. I don't know, because maybe that's what really happens is you kind of get screwed up your freshman year or sophomore year, and then it's like you can't take that time to go back and redo, and you can't. I feel really bad if like you wanted to be a scientist. And for some reason you had a terrible freshman year, like that could really screw you up from ever being a scientist. When in reality, you should just have another year of high school and redo that. But yeah, that's really hard to hear. Cause it's a delicate balance. You know,
I also got really bad grades freshman year in English. And I still became a writer. So I defeated that. I don't know. It's, you know, yeah, it's complicated, right?
So next question here. Travis, you said, what pinball machines are in the bar? I see something that says wildlife. So as the pinball expert on the podcast, I assume this looks like an older EM machine. Let me bring this up. Actually, probably should look at this episode really quick and see. I am no longer distracted by pinball machines in the background of things. They're almost always a real pinball machine. Nobody makes up a fake one except, I think, like Anchorman 2 made up some fake ones, you know, but in general, they're all real machines. No, Dennis, you're a pinball expert. Did you recognize it?
I didn't, no. I saw it was there.
Wildlife, manufactured November 1972, from November 1972, D. Gottlieb and Country and Company.
So here's the pinball knowledge I want to give everybody. If you see a pinball machine that isn't from the 90s, like late 80s to 90s, like it's basically like the era of muscle cars, right? When they were really good and everybody's into cars into them, right? So 80s and 90s, best era for pinball machines. If it's outside of that era, I don't even care. So machines like that don't register. There you go.
You can be a snob about anything, folks.
Solid pinball advice. Dang.
Travis says, how the hell did Kendra find Angel's apartment?
I guess
everybody knows where Angel's apartment is. Yeah. It is common knowledge. Xander just spreads that knowledge around town.
There is a show called Angel. I mean, they are going to find his place, right? Like, okay. Next one, Travis here. Was Xander's hosing down of Cordelia funny or cringeworthy?
I'm just trying to get a feel for what you feel, what you all think. I think it was totally cringeworthy and not funny enough to register like, as something to have kept, but.
I think it could have gone on for another half hour or something.
Sorry. You know, the Xander Cordelia basement makeout scene that took place, like, I mean, that was the most cringy thing that's happened so far in this episode.
Yeah. And that wasn't more cringeworthy than hosing down a high school girl. Come on. That's corny, but it's not cringy.
They at least had a reason, and I didn't feel like the way it was shot was particularly exploitative. That was my read on it, because the whole thing's done in a long shot, pretty much.
Yeah, no, it's just.
I think Xander gets a little into it, though.
They show him, so it's not like they're exposing her body, but it's like, it shot, I don't know. It just was just sort of like, I rolled my eyes because it was like the horny Xander moment I didn't want.
Yeah, no, I agree. Are we going to talk about
the kiss?
Oh,
that's
sorry.
That's like a real Xander moment. Like, it wasn't horny, like dirty horny. It was just a normal human emotion reaction situation.
Well, I think we should go to your question, John.
Yeah. So here's my thing. Like, why, like, this whole idea of, you know, I'm going to treat you like shit, but then it's secretly because I have a crush on you. Is that a real thing that real people do, or is that only exist in sitcoms? Because I think that's not real. That's my take. What's your take?
I agree. I don't think it's real. Unless it's the thing that they're into. Abuse. There's a lot of, kinky stuff going on in this episode.
Yeah. I've never treated anybody that way when I had a crush on them, as far as I know. And I don't really feel like I know anybody who's done that. But what I have seen is I've seen that idea used as like an excuse for shitty male behavior of like, oh, you're being mean. You know, he's being mean to you, but it's okay. It's because he likes you. That I've seen. But this whole like Sam and Diane nonsense of like the abuse is really a way for them to flirt is, I don't feel like that's real.
So I agree. I mean, it sounds like it's a normalized form of domestic abuse where if you have parents that are like kind of like back and forth and mean to each other, you kind of learn that that's okay. And you have a certain expectation that that's all right. So when it happens, it doesn't push you off like it should. So like in my psych read of this would be that both Cordelia and Xander have shitty households, you know, which is partially why they behave the way they do, but like that their parents are probably both into this kind of have disastrous relationships with each other, though I assume they're not divorced. I don't know. It's not real, but it's like good for, you know, screenwriting, right? Because it's like these characters have opposite energies and then they come together and then you get an antithesis and then we can move to the next scene. And to like a thesis of two ideas that come together. I mean, if characters are just ideas, but yeah, that always rubs me the wrong way. That scene, I you see it coming, you're like, oh, please.
I mean, my read on the situation, which is just a bit different, is these are two characters who like each other, but they come from such different socioeconomic backgrounds that they can't, that they don't want to like each other. So to me, it's more of a physical attraction overcoming societal norms. That's how I read their relationship, rather than the other thing, John, you're asking something separate, which is people who normally are attracted to each other, treating each other badly, which I think there must be, as our friend Dusty would say, I think there's a kernel of truth there that they've expanded. I think there's some form of that is true, and TV just always expands it up to be like way more over the top than that. I bet there is some form of negative reinforcement or negative interaction with someone that you do like, but never to the extent that's on television.
All right. Dennis asks, Buffy likes pineapples on her pizza. Where do you stand on pineapple?
I'm pro pineapple on pizza.
Pro. Definite wow. Pro.
Awesome.
Mike?
I'm against it. I don't want to eat that pizza.
Judas.
I feel like pineapples on pizza are like really hated in our society. So I was happy that Buffy said pineapples on her pizza along with the Molly Ringwald. So suck it.
I think in a, you know, I'll bring it up, but I said like Molly, you know, Molly Ringwald is like a great, great way to date yourself, because in that time, Molly Ringwald was cool, and then in the early 2000s, it would not have been cool. But now the 80s are cool again, so it's just a weird way to like. I wonder what people on. Actually, I've never seen Gossip Girl. I wonder what some of the, like modern day television shows would be like. Let's go binge watch blank. Maybe it's Buffy that they'd binge watch, but I don't know what the cool movie would be.
I think it is Buffy. I mean, we're doing it, and we're cool, obviously.
So cool.
But yeah, like what's the Breakfast Club of this age, of now, of 2017?
Is it like Harry Potter, because everyone likes Harry Potter?
Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, we're further from Buffy now than Buffy was from the Breakfast Club. Because that was about like only 12 years, 13 years in Correct. Between.
Yeah.
So, boy, I don't know. I don't have to say, but other than that, we're really old. That's all I can say.
Right. So you'd have to be looking at 06, 07, that like 05, 08 era for a romantic comedy to that connects with young people for them to reflect on now. Or 2005, that'd be 12 years, right? That would be our age when we're reflecting on Ringwald. So what would that be?
It would have to be a good movie. It couldn't just be like a romantic comedy. It'd have to be like a good one.
It doesn't have to be good to connect with the people.
Well, it should be because Molly Ringwald was kind of a good 80s star. Not all her movies were good, but a lot of them were. Thanks to John Landis. And John Hughes.
John Hughes. Yeah.
I don't think John Landis actually directed her in anything that I'm aware of. Mainly John Hughes.
I don't think she's in like Kentucky Fried movie or anything.
I should look to see if John Landis helped.
So what about, would it be Brokeback Mountain? Would you be talking about Gyllenhaal?
Yeah, okay. Wow, that was, yeah. Or maybe the Anne Hathaway oeuvre. How about that? It would be Anne Hathaway being the Molly Ringwald of the early 2000s.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think Anne Hathaway is about as good as you're going to get as an analog.
Juno is 2007. You know, you could talk about Ellen Page.
Yeah.
Juno is, oh my gosh, we are so old. That feels like that movie's new.
Yeah, so you could say like,
it's only 10 years old.
Yeah, I feel like Ellen Page right now. You know, I'm pregnant. And I don't know what to do next. Yeah, we are old. Movies prove it.
Yep. This is the podcast where we get together every week and reflect on how old we are.
So this next one here, Travis says, has anyone eaten the awful looking bar eggs in a jar?
Yes, and they're not awful. Those are pickled eggs. And
you've made
excellent.
Them, right?
I have purchased them in establishments. I have made my own. I will stand up for the pickled egg. They are excellent. It's eggs and vinegar. I mean, what else do you want? It's wonderful.
So have they already been deshelled?
Yeah. So you it's really basically you boil an egg, you peel it, and then you pickle it. It's a quick pickle, so you just pickle it in vinegar. And you add, when I do it, I do it with beets and spices, which is the sort of the purple ones, which you'll see sometimes because they get purple from the beets. But the ones in the bars, I think, are typically just salt and vinegar. So they're just, you know, sour and salty and eggy, and they're really, really good.
So see, I would eat a 1,000-year-old egg over a pickled bar egg.
It's just vinegar. Those 1,000-year-old eggs are like buried under the dirt. I mean, I'd eat one of those too if I had the opportunity. Those are hard to come by.
Would you eat the beef jerky in the open container at the grocery store? Or, I mean, sorry, at the gas station?
No, I don't think so.
So this episode focuses, now we're moving on to themes. Travis, you said this episode focuses more heavily on the sins of the father concept in regards to the curse of the slayers.
Actually, I want to expand that because it's a two-part, two-type sins of the father. One is sins of the father regarding Angel, and the other is the pseudo-sins of the father regarding the slayers. And so it's really obsessed with sins of the father because, you know, this is all about Angel. When he was bad, he was called Angelus, and he did many unconscionable things. One of the worst was Drusilla. This is sort of a pseudo-quote, I'm paraphrasing from a couple episodes ago. Angel says, I did many unconscionable things when I was a vampire. So basically this episode revolves around, you know, him sort of paying up for what he did to Drusilla. And he hasn't been able to escape that even since he got a soul and is trying to be a good person, but this still is flying back in his face. And then of course with the Slayers, it's all about this idea of, we'll get there eventually, but how Buffy's her, she doesn't really have sin that she has to pay do penance for, but it's her destiny is the other is like the flip side. It's where she's fighting her destiny, which is kind of a sad destiny, which is yes, she'll fight evil. Yes, she has superpowers, but she will die. There will be another slayer. And so similar concepts, but they're treated a little bit differently. They're both treated very seriously, which is good. And they both really involve a lot of free will. So it's a really interesting theme that they come back to during the story. So I just want to get your opinion on that. To me, that's what I see the theme is here. And that's the theme of the whole series, but it's really brought to light in this specific two-parter.
Yeah, I feel like we've had this conversation before in different episodes of Buffy, right? Because the destiny of this being a Slayer is like such a part of this show.
And here is
speaking of Angel being a bad, paying for his sins as a father. There's that Drusilla has that line. You've been a very bad daddy.
I meant to rewatch the episode School Hard, but when Spike says to Angel, did Spike say, you are my sire, man, or you are my Yoda? I can't remember what he said to Angel.
He says both. You are my sire, man, my Yoda.
Yeah, we've got to come back to that.
Don't Uncle Tommy. Yeah, that whole stuff. Yep.
We got to come back to that. Because Spike uses sire in a loose term there. We have to come back to that at some point.
All right. So moving on here, we're going
Do you think the sins of the father thing is like a legit theme that they're employing, or am I making that up?
You're not making it up, but you know, the next thing we were going to talk about is whether or not the episode really needs to be stretched over two episodes. And I think my answer to that is no. I felt like this episode was pretty boring. And the reason why is I think you're totally on point with those themes, but that's territory we've sort of covered already. And I felt like we were reintroduced to every character in this episode. And it's, you know, it's the nature of episodic television of this era. But I just felt like we were being re-explained again that Buffy feels a sense of destiny that she's uncomfortable with, yada, yada, yada. And this is not the best example of those themes that Buffy has ever given us. And it feels like it drags to me. I don't think it needs to be two episodes. I definitely don't need two episodes worth of bad fake Jamaican accent.
Speaking of explaining the characters and stuff, I do like the line where Xander's like, hey, Angel's our friend. Except I don't like him. Like, thank you for explaining that character that way.
Yeah, I love that line. Is still amazing. I love that line. Actually, and I will say, because we're kind of going random for a second, this has my favorite Buffy line that I use all the time in real life. And it's the expression, I'll jump off that bridge when I get to it. And I say that line in real life all the time, and nobody really gets how crazy that is, but it's an amazing line. And I encourage you to use it at home.
I picked up that one as well. I was thinking of incorporating that into my lexicon. I'm glad that you've already been pulling that weight.
Oh, yeah. Whenever there's a tough decision, yeah, I say that. So you'll notice that.
I don't know if I want to hear that line from my doctor, though. It's like, but doctor, what about like the long-term effects of that chemo? We'll jump off that bridge when we get to it. Fuck.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I use it when appropriate. You're right. I'll say this. I'm with you. This was a two-part episode that I think made more sense on the script pages. And again, I encourage everyone to listen to Marty Noxon because she talks about this as well. She says we do very few two-part episodes. And she says it's very difficult to do two-part episodes because oftentimes you feel like you have enough material for one and a half episodes. And to me, this was tough because the story was good, but it lacked a lot of oomph. And I don't want to be too critical because I probably cannot actually be critical of Buffy, but I agree with John. This should have been a one-part episode, or I think this should have been a one-part episode and split up or focus more on one-part episode with Buffy's trying to figure out her job, her future, her career, all that sort of stuff, and then the next episode figure out this this concept of redemption. And redemption is a rocky road, but I agree.
You could do full 5 seasons about redemption.
Yeah, and I've got...
I guess, like, I didn't respond to the sins of the father thing because I didn't understand where you're going with that. Like where you're saying that there's this curse of the slayers. I mean, and, like, where that... You're saying Spike is punished, or rather, Angel is punished because he... of what he did to Drusilla, and this is his punishment finally coming to realization.
So the whole concept of sins of the fathers is, it's like a religious concept. I guess it's in the Bible. But this is the concept where you pay for the sins committed by people who came before you. For Angel, when he was a vampire, he did a lot of bad things, killed a lot of people, and he got a soul back. It doesn't make a lot of sense because you haven't seen any flashbacks, Mike. And I know this concept doesn't make a lot of sense, I guess. But he got a soul back, and he's trying to be a good person, but he keeps running up against these things, these problems, these things he can't escape, these things he did bad in the past. And so I think it's for him, it's over the top, but it's all about, you know, when you look at your own life, can you be a good person if you've done bad things in your life? Or would you always pay for your sins? You know, in this case, it's not sins of the father; it's your sins. Versus the slayers have the reverse problem. It's not being a sin, but they are cursed every generation from like the primeval or primordial slayer to have this short life where they can't choose what they wanted to be. Kind of a curse.
Oh, the curse of the slayer is being the slayer. And you don't get to have a regular life. I guess I'm not following the angel thing, but I don't know, you know, I guess I don't know the whole story. So I'm missing a lot of details here, but definitely in the seasons I've watched this, what played out where he's being sacrificed, you know, or in so that Drusilla can be, you know, made stronger is because of what he did to Drusilla. I mean, that's what maybe story-wise is happening. That they capture Angel and like they feel totally justified, and they are for doing that, for what the terrible stuff Angel did to her, that were empathetic to Angel. So I agree. Yeah, this could have been one episode, but they clearly wanted to drag this out for a reason because they think it's really important that this happened. I think we covered other John's questions.
Yeah, I think you could also structurally have written it a little differently, like where you could have had first episode be all about what's my line, meeting the other slayer and fighting the other slayer. And then it ends. And then the second episode would be all about Spike and Angel. And like the fact that they have another slayer in town being like the strategic advantage that helps them at the end, instead of like the episode. Cause this two-parter doesn't have two clear episodes, right? It is very much like just one episode extended. They could have structured it a little differently, but anyway, keep going.
Cool. So we're moving on now to Dennis's kill count or in predictions. Oh, I guess we'll do predictions first here. How are we on predictions, John? Did any of them come true? Oh, John, you're muted.
Sorry, fellas. I've got one that is definitely confirmed and another that is a bit of a half confirmation. So the one that is definitely confirmed, and you'll have to bear with me for a second because I didn't realize we were getting that close to it. Let me open it up. Okay, sorry. The one that is definitely confirmed is that Mike predicted that Xander will fall in with Cordelia. So that's a pretty major prediction confirmed in this episode. I'm assuming we're going to go ahead and count making out as falling in. The letter of the prediction says that he will fall in with Cordelia. I'm going to go ahead and count that. Now, the one that I'm a little more iffy on, now Mike said in season 1, episode 10, Mike predicted that young Buffy will appear. And in this episode, we see a photo of young Buffy. So, Peanut Gallery, what do you think? Is that prediction confirmed? Or we can leave that open.
Okay, they're saying not confirmed.
Okay, so Dennis and Travis say it is not confirmed. We're going to leave that one open, that young Buffy may still appear at a later date, but for now, there's just the one prediction confirmed that Xander has fallen in with Cordelia for this episode.
Okay, I have a prediction for moving forward. I believe the Jamaican Slayer Kendra will appear again, and she's going to be killed. I think that they've created a fun character to throw away in this episode. I predict that Spike will be healed from whatever weakness will be temporary. Cordelia and Xander will make out again. And it's not long for Oz and Willow. Something has to happen by the end of this season. I'm losing my mind. Whether that's like a cute kiss that gets big, I imagine it would be like a little cute peck and then like a big make out. Once Willow gets the okay that it's cool. Oh, we can kiss now. How fun. Then it'll happen.
Okay. I feel like these predictions are a little safe, most of them. So I'm going to push you on a couple of these. So you said Kendra will appear again and be killed. Is that going to be in the same episode?
Yes.
I'm going to put that as one prediction, that she will appear again and be killed.
The next time she appears, she'll be killed.
Oh, okay.
Because she's going to be killed by whatever the next big monster is. She'll appear in an episode where the next big monster will appear and she'll be killed. May not be in this season.
When you say Spike will be healed of his weakness, I feel like we need to peg that to a season, because I don't feel like that's really going on a limb.
All right. How many episodes are left in the season? Like 12? 16 episodes in this season? It'll be this season.
Okay. Okay, good. Same thing with Cordelia and Xander making out again. Again, I don't feel like you're really going on a limb there.
This season. They'll make out in this season.
Okay, good. Great. That's good. So we have some season 2 specific predictions. That's good. So our predictions this episode are that Kendra will appear again and be killed in the same episode. Spike will be healed of his weakness during season 2. Cordelia and Xander will make out again in season 2, and also in season 2, Willow and Oz will get together.
Yes. And there might be a real Jonathan focused episode in season 2.
Oh.
Which I'm guessing, because you are all obsessed with him and all you talk about, you're like, this is a Jonathan episode, and that's it. That's all that happened. He's barely in this episode.
I did love seeing Jonathan in this episode. He has one line, he's great.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about Jonathan very much.
No reason to.
Or Seth Green. There's a lot of things we're leaving out. Jonathan, Seth Green, you know, Oz. And all right, let's go to
Seth Green. Oz takes a bullet.
I know. I have a recommendation I want to get out, because the mic will go over me. So recommendation I have for today, it's a movie called In a World. And it's about voice acting and accents and such. And it's the movie is In a World. And it stars Lake Bell, who wrote and directed it and is the main star. And you used to be able to watch it on Netflix, but if you can't watch it on Netflix, it is pretty awesome. So I definitely highly recommend it. It's a comedy and came out in 2013. That's my recommendation.
Good Rick. Yes, I like that movie. I was thinking about the bug guy, and I picked two movies that have lots of bugs. Kingdom of the Spiders with Will Shatner, and Ticks starring Seth Green about giant ticks. And Clint Howard's in that movie also. And then I was also trying to think of, like, because obviously, like, I really liked Drusilla in this episode. So I was trying to think about movies with, like, crazy Drusilla type characters. And it was hard for me to, like, come up with that. But I kind of picked To the Devil a Daughter. Because of the whole thing about being, like, raised a nun, or being, like, trying to be a nun and then being crazy. So The Devil Daughter's got Christopher Lee, and it's got Natasha Kinski. And I was also thinking about, I don't know, like, I was a little bit thinking about Dr. Caligari, which I probably have recommended before in this movie, just because, like, there's some crazy kinky business in that movie also. So those were my recs, yeah.
To be clear, that's 1989's Dr. Caligari, not the German silent film.
Yeah, by Rent's Dream. It's a weird fucking movie. It's one of my favorite movies. So,
yeah. Cannot recommend enough. 5 stars. Yeah. Would buy again. Dr. Caligari, 1989.
I have a VHS copy and a bootleg DVD of it that I've spent way too much money on owning this movie that's hard to find.
It's out on like actual DVD now. You can just buy it now.
Oh my god! I spent too much money.
There's like a there's some distributor who mostly does porn who has released it.
Nice. Kill count.
Yeah.
I got one human, three vampires, and the three members of the Order of Tarakas. So that was my kill count.
So disappointed that another vampire order is just destroyed instantly. That could have been a whole season.
I really wasn't sure if the policewoman was killed or not because she was just like kicked into stuff. But then I was like, the church was set on fire, so she's probably dead. I'll call it a death.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does she have powers or is she just a human? We don't really know. But she's as tough as a slayer.
Same thing with the road warrior guy. He just seems to be a dude.
Yeah. Is he human? Is he like part demon? I don't know. He's vulnerable to ice skates to the neck.
Like a human.
Much like a human.
Well, this was a great episode to talk about. We'll do this again next week with episode 11. Ted?
Ted.
All right.
We'll do a Ted talk.
John Ritter.